It is a great pleasure to welcome to Best Ideas 2023 returning MOI Global instructor Frank Fischer, the CEO of Shareholder Value Management AG, where he is also Chief Investment Officer. Frank is also a board member of Shareholder Value Beteiligungen AG. Until the end of 2005, Frank was managing director of Standard & Poor's Fund Services and was responsible for investment fund information and ratings. After completing his training as a banker at the Hessische Landesbank, he completed a degree in business administration at the University of Frankfurt with a degree in business administration. Frank is the founder and director of the nonprofit foundation Starke Lunge. Always a great pleasure to have you with us, Frank. I very much look forward to your remarks today and would like to turn it to you now. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Welcome from Shareholder Value Management in Frankfurt. Today, I want to share our view on SAP, the ERP company that I'm sure you already are familiar with to some extent. And we consider this to be now a SaaS story. It's really in a transformation and it's already progressed quite a bit. And I want to give you our views on what we think this really is going to do for us, the returns you can expect, the opportunities and the risks that we see in that business. Before I start with SAP, just want to give you a little bit of a last year's review. And here's the chart, AB InBev, basically investment bankers that happen to be brewing beer. And they're doing reasonably well considering the challenging times that we have, the input price inflation that we have seen and how to handle it. And our story seems to be doing all right. I think these guys will continue to perform well and they do great capital allocation. And in many markets, these guys are so dominant that they actually generate wonderful EBIT margins. And I think it's good to keep on holding on to that position. So these are just wonderful business ideas, and that's basically what we are looking for. The key aspect of that is what we call modern value, because value investing is typically looked at, I'm saying, you know, it's really nice to look at the Benjamin Graham type of way, where you look at low PE ratios, low price book ratios, and that's the classical way to look at value investing. However, if you really look at the returns of Berkshire Hathaway and you listen to these guys, Charlie Munger in particular, but also Warren, they have said very clearly that it is something much better to look at wonderful companies instead of looking at just average companies. So if you pay a fair price for a wonderful company, it is much better than paying a wonderful price for a fair company, is a summary. And we actually agree fully. And this is why our focus is very much shifted on these wonderful companies. And we also think that in the structurally changing inflationary times, this will provide us with a very good protection because we will actually not be a victim to inflation, but rather we will actually have a chance of achieving real returns. Nominal returns will look good anyway for most companies, but real returns, that will be a challenge. And I do understand that we are now already in a disinflationary environment again, but the debt won't go away unless we have financial repression. So I would expect the inflation later this year or into next year to come back and stay there. And this is why it's really important to make sure that you look for wonderful companies that have pricing power and are protected by moats in order to achieve real returns. Now, when you look at what wonderful companies do, it's important to look at growth. Now, value and growth are joined at the hip, as Buffett says. So value investing is always looking at growth because it's part of what really gives you the cash flows. And so if you actually achieve something like twice GDP, that's what we're looking for, growing faster than the economy, that's ideal. And so we would like these companies to be better in their respective industries, so growing above their peers. And the sector focus that we have is really looking at those sectors where sales growth is bigger than normal growth in the economy. So then the question is, do you really get good capital returns? And do these companies do that in a way where they're better than their peers? And if that's the case, well, then that's really wonderful because you actually might see that they're doing something better. That might also be a cultural thing in the business, or they might be more innovative, or they're better protected. But you know, it's not just the moat that exists, but also building, deepening, widening the moat, which is critically important. And that's part of the culture and the talents that you actually can attract into your business. Well, if those markets tend to be growing markets, real growth markets that might even do better in the future, that's even more exciting. So we would like that to be the case, ideally. And of course, we would like then to have management looking at being quite opportunistic and not following the crowd. So only when opportunities come up, they should really look at deploying capital and not just do something where they're actually doing value destructive M&A. This is really difficult because most of these wonderful businesses, there tends to be some kind of level of, well, we do what everyone else does. And so that's one of the criteria where we usually look at family and business owner run companies because they tend to get it more. They have more skin in the game, and share-based compensation for them is not just something where they don't have to commit their own capital, but they actually, the management, if they just benefit from whatever they do, and if they don't do it well, they just drop the job and go somewhere else and try their luck there. So we really like it when there's skin in the game. The innovation element I already mentioned, because it's critically important to just be ahead of your competition or at least keep up with them. And so you really have to constantly innovate. There is so many changes out there that you can't really bet on what you know from the past as being true for as long as it used to. So in many places, that is just not the case anymore in many industries. And of course, is there enough robustness in the business? Is there a certain capacity to suffer if things go against you? We just had the issue with a war popping up last year, which is still going on, and that was kind of unexpected. And so the question is, if the business is resilient enough to withstand these issues, for example, SAP, they looked at their Russian operation and decided that is not something that they want to continue. And that, of course, has an impact on your earnings. And so the question is, how do you do in case of adverse effects? Now, another element which is critical is how you allocate capital and how you reinvest the earnings and whether you actually generate even better growing returns on the earnings that you keep and then reinvest. Well, unfortunately, that is something in most big businesses that tends to be this empire building attitude rather than looking at the return of incrementally invested capital. So that's the perfect world that we look for. And then you have to kind of factor in the multiples that you're prepared to pay for it when the world isn't as perfect as you wish. Just to give you the view again, and basically it's all about compounding. When you really think about inflation and you really think that in a typical Graham style business that is not even generating its cost of capital, then you might even get a decent return if it bounces back. but you're not going to be doing well if you a business keeper and hold on to that business. So time really is the enemy of a bad company, and it's the friend of the wonderful company. So if you do look for businesses that have 20 or 25%, so really high double-digit returns on equity, then you'll do extremely well. And just to give you this in a graphic view, here you can see, even if you have business one with 50% safety margin, that would be the Benjamin Graham type investment, and then you have a 6% return. Well, clearly, if you buy it so cheaply, you'll do all right if it bounces back. But the business number two, where the safety margin is only 30%, but it delivers these wonderful returns on capital, then you actually do much better over time. And this is what the idea is, that over time, you know, the enemy is really time for the weak business, and it's the friend of the wonderful business. So the question is, what is a wonderful business? And we actually labeled this modern value because we want to differentiate between the classical Graham style value and the way that Munger and Buffett later on looked at generating their returns. And they mentioned that it's by far more important what they achieved for Berkshire by actually looking at this modern value style. And so they actually look for growth. And this is something which most people have difficulties with. Some investors and fund managers label it quality investing. And I tend to agree with that label because the business quality is important. And that is what modern value style is about. It's all been said by Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, but now people put different labels on it. And this is why I just call it modern value style. So these businesses with above average returns on capital, and then ideally having incrementally better results by investing in the same thing and not in something new, at least adjacent, so that you know what you're doing, because many businesses tend to go into areas where they are not experts, and then they realize they're not experts and they made the wrong capital allocation decision. And if you look for moats and you really have such a protection that it can last for a long time, then even a weak management will not destroy your castle. And that is something which is important, because management can be changed, and typically an activist will come in and enact that change. And also, since we do not like in adverse scenarios that the bank steps in and you get this kind of debt to equity swap, moderate debt levels which are appropriate for the business is something that we look for, because we don't like the huge amount of leverage. Some businesses can live with more because they're more resilient, even in adverse times, but mostly we tend to look for very moderate debt levels. With SAP, that is the case. Then, of course, the principal agent conflicts is something that we deal with in any businesses, in any business that we look at. And so we really prefer ideally owner-managed or family-run businesses, because there you have skin in the game. And there tends to be more of sustainable, economically positive decisions being made in these businesses where people have skin in the game. When you look at the types of moats, here are the moats that we look for, the main ones, the network effect, as we see Meta, even though it's hammered down because no one thinks that the metaverse will deliver the returns that Mark Zuckerberg is looking for, but you know, it's still protected. Even though this is being challenged by TikTok, he is actually throwing off a lot of cash still, and he can use that and deploy it to reinvent himself, and we'll find out whether that is a good idea or not. It's a business risk he decides to take. And there are, of course, other moats, and I'm sure that you've looked at moats before. Just to highlight, switching costs here, our example with SAP, the ERP switching costs are very high. And that is because many businesses have actually customized their ERP offering based on SAP. And so it's really difficult to move away. And also, when you think about, you know, reducing costs, there are many places you can reduce costs, but you can't get rid of your ERP. You stop doing business. If you do that as a decent business, you just can't just go back on and have it all on paper and Excel. That is something which is not really state of the art and becomes unimaginable for a decent sized business. So here we go. SAP. The sector they're in is the B2B software space. Being one of the leaders in ERP for corporates is something where they have global reach. And it's not just the Germanic companies which they followed into the world, but they are now everywhere. And yes, they are in a fierce battle with the likes of Microsoft Dynamics, depending on the size, or with Oracle. But the switching cost protects them. Once you're in there, it's hard to get out. And of course, the question is, if you are a pure play business in that sector, you will actually do very, very well because you actually cater to the needs of your customers. So that place is relatively predictable and sticky, which we like. Of course, some businesses just drop out because they go bankrupt. Others are taken over. So you will have some level of churn. And we think it is around 5%, just to be careful. We're also maybe going into recession. Maybe it's a soft landing. Who knows? But the thing is, we have to assume some level of churn. The good news, though, is we have really wonderful cash flows, which are recurring. Either you're still in the old on-prem world, where you have license and maintenance, or increasingly through the transition, you get the recurring revenue through software as a service model. The market cap that we have, and the EV shows you also that the balance sheet is healthy, is around the 122 billion mark. That's the most recent data. So what is our thesis? The first and most important element is that we are in the SaaS transition. So we go from what you've seen in other businesses, and we're actually now picking up speed there, going from the license and maintenance model into recurring through the S/4HANA transition. The new product, or rather not that new, it's actually quite mature. This is also what I like, that this has been around for a long, long time. 2015, when it was announced in the earlier years, there were still a lot of teething issues, but it's become much more mature and stable. And so now a rollout and the pickup, because customers understand that this is now a stable and good product. And also, when you then tell them that, you know, we're going to be stopping support in the future, and if you want to continue support for your old stuff, well, you'll get it, but you'll pay premium price for that. So they actually put the pressure on the customers to then embrace this transition, which involves a lot of customization and is a huge project for some businesses. So they don't really like that, but they know that the most likely success they will have by staying with SAP and transitioning into their world and not changing. There is a risk that you change to a competitor, but we think that it is very likely that they'll stay with SAP. Now, in the past, there were lots of businesses acquired in the SaaS world to embrace this theme in the market. And yes, they did pay quite hefty prices for that. But the growth there was around the 20% before COVID. We still assume growth going forward in those businesses because they are growing businesses and they actually fit into the entire ERP and B2B space. So we also believe into some degree of margin expansion. And we will also compare that against Oracle. Just to give you an idea, if they actually, which in the past they haven't done, focus on margin, they have a lot of room to catch up with Oracle. In a way, Oracle is the much better run for profit business. Of course, with all the buybacks, the balance sheet is very different from SAP's. But, you know, you have very different attitudes here in the business and different culture. And when you look at the resilience and what what SAP does for you, we think it's pretty good to also have this in the back of your mind that this could be an investable idea. So we believe that the growth path is very visible, even though we are in this potentially recessionary environment, because we also have a good protection against the inflation challenges that we see. And we do think that even though we're in a transition, the churn will be quite modest. So where are we with the new ERP product? This is has been launched S/4HANA in 15, and now the goal is to migrate all or almost all of them into the new world. That is something where clearly if you tell the customers initially support ends at 25, at the end of year 25, you now had pressure from the client saying, you know, we do want to change, but you need to give us a bit more time. So the normal support now ends after 2027. So you still have time to change. They're your customers. You won't play hardball with these guys. And maybe they will extend it by another year or so. Irregardless of that, there is an expense which goes up for that continued support offering, because in the end, for SAP, offering that support will also mean that they have technical debt, since they'll have to maintain the old code, keep it up with cybersecurity protection patches, etc. And so you can expect those that won't change will pay a higher price. And that's really the important bit here, that this will be very profitable even for those customers that refuse to change into the new world or will take longer. This could take really all the way into the 30s before everyone is switched over. So basically, we assume 11.5 billion maintenance and support revenues in 19, which were from 80% from this ECC 6.0. This stems from roughly 25 to 30,000 customers. This is basically what we can look at the annual reports and the transcripts. We look at that being close to the reality. Now, not everything is being communicated with every level of detail, so you have to make some assumptions, and we talk to industry experts, etc. But where we're quite comfortable, even being quite conservative, is that we look at the outcomes that we consider, and that there is a level of uplift which is possible to us. So if you choose to upgrade from ECC 6.0 to S/4HANA, then the uplift is relatively modest, at 1.2 times at the very lowest end. But probably it's more likely in the 1.3 to 1.4 times. If you think that you'll go into a license and maintenance payment model, which is still being offered. So you can choose. If you want to be on-prem, you can still do that. Much more interesting in the long run is that at the higher end for the subscriptions, you'll have a 2.25 uplift. That's the indication from SAP. This is part of their guidance. So if you choose to have it in your private cloud, that might even be higher. So on average, our assumption is 1.8 times uplift. We think there will be quite wide adoption going into the cloud over time. And we think that there will still be a lot of conservatism in many industries and a lot of very high switching costs that by 25, not everyone will have converted. So 40% might still continue to be in the on-prem world and pay the classical license and maintenance model. So assuming that, we think that by 25, 60% of current ECC 6.0 customers might have switched. So when we look at trying to be very conservative and not factoring in the inflation, and they have a lot of pricing power and they have inflation adjustments in their contractual agreements, we think that the ERP businesses, they can grow around 2.5 CAGR. And that's based on the assumptions I've just shared with you. This is quite conservative, and you then can figure out yourself what you think about inflation and how much can be passed on to clients. But we do want to have downside protection with our assumptions here. And we know that pricing power will be higher than what we've assumed here. Churn, you know, that's something where we feel quite comfortable because it's even Oracle won't be that much cheaper, that's for sure. And switching from one world to the other is always a risky project. So the question really is, how much more upside is there? And I'm very happy to look at that free optionality of further upside, but I'd rather share with you a conservative view. Now, the other element is the acquired businesses' growth. And here are the companies that were acquired, some of them which you undoubtedly know. It was under Bill McDermott's tenure where those SaaS businesses were acquired. And they have grown, as I mentioned before, above 20% per annum. We still assume 11% growth going forward. So these businesses have suffered a bit during the COVID times, et cetera, and maybe in the recessionary environment, they will also have a bit of an impact, but we still think that they can do quite well going forward because it is very good to stay in this ecosystem, and it is just something where the ERP platform, which is at the core of all these offerings, it makes a lot of sense to stay within this world. And they've done a good job of integrating it and delivering the interfaces required so that you're quite seamless in the integration here. So let's look at margins. What is our assumption here? We think that actually you can become more profitable with what they're currently trying to get to is 30 basis points per annum, operating margin expansion over the time period until 25. And that is looking at it before the share-based compensation. That's the element that we don't like so much here because that's quite hefty. Now, it could be that share-based compensation in the past was higher than it is in the future, but you know that's not an assumption that I'm very comfortable with because governance at SAP, even though it is owner-run, is not the greatest at all. Yes, there is a lot of willingness to adapt and innovate, etc., and that's great from the owners, but there could be better governance. The articles in the magazines and newspapers are full of things which you really don't like when you dig deeper. So that's something where we're also not prepared to pay a higher multiple for this business. The SAP guidance itself is something where they try to guess as much as we do what it could be. And we do think there is quite a tremendous margin potential if they ever become more cost conscious. But we think that 20% operating margin in 25 is something which is doable. It could be more, but history shows that they haven't been really that good at achieving more. So why should we give them that for them? I think it doesn't make sense from the history. You can't see that this is what's in it for them. They don't have that wonderful aggressive commercial culture that you see at Oracle, where they're relentlessly focusing on really decent capital allocation on buybacks. SAP doesn't do much buybacks, only maybe to cover for some of those options. This is very different here, and we have to factor that in. So potentially there is big upside if there's management change, which has a tendency to look at that, but we would not assume that being the case. So these are this is the chart which just compares the operating margin over time. And as you can see, being focused on 20%, we are actually below what they have achieved historically. They could bounce back to higher, but we would like to be positively surprised. And if they were going towards the Oracle, I mean, that would be a dream. But since the history is more of a downtrend, yeah, we look at trend reversion, regression to the mean. We hope so, but let's assume it's only modest and only going to 20%. It will be good enough for us. So what are the returns and what is our recommendation? What do we think is really in it for you if you look at that investment idea? We think that we get to roughly 5% top line growth. So 2.5 coming from the core ERP and the rest coming from the acquired SaaS businesses like Concur, etc. That would take it to 35.5 billion revenues in 25. And that would give us, with a 20% operating margin assumption, 6% earnings growth per year. So we think that it will be slower in earlier years and then growth speeding up in the later years, since also, you know, the end of support is actually forcing the customers to finally embrace it. And maybe it's going to be a weaker year this year because of the recessionary issues and you put a project on hold, et cetera. But that is something where we follow pretty much the guidance of SAP for the long term. And we do think that there's a valid guidance and that this is not really a stretched one. The churn is something that we factored in. And we do believe that even after that time frame, things will continue to convert into the new world, into S/4HANA. So there will continue, there will be continued churn. Either they go elsewhere or they convert into S/4HANA. So we think that there will be a 6% top line growth going forward. That is also assuming a bit of an inflationary effect. So maybe going up from 5 to 6, something that's on the top line is doable for them. And if there's more inflation, it will be structurally higher. But you know, nominal and real, those assumptions are something that you will have to do yourself. I'm actually in the camp of thinking inflation will be structurally higher. I think from 24, 25, it probably should be something like 4%. And if that's the case, then things will be different. And especially since these guys can do pricing increases, and as they've done in the past, and yes, they have really upset the customers here, but they push through, and so they have that pricing power. The main risk, apart from all the macro risks that you know, for me is execution of this transition, making sure that there are no big issues that interfere with it. Why I'm quite comfortable is that the product has been out there since 2015, and a lot of the teething issues have been dealt with. And so there's a lot of experience and a lot of consultants helping you with the transition, looking at your database tables and taking it into the new world, converting it. They have a team doing this conversion in-house. There are outside companies from Accenture. I mean, anyone that sells your daily bodies, basically, is trying to help you with this transition. There's a huge ecosystem that will enable this. So to some extent, it's not so much their execution risk, but there is a risk for that execution, which I consider to be one that we have to kind of monitor. Of course, there are other issues as well, but we don't see competition being the key risk here. We think they are really best in class with their ERP offering. So looking at SAP and what they actually have handed out, here you can see the total revenue line, the operating profit, and the cloud revenue that is actually then giving you the CAGRs for their 25 guidance. And they think it's going to be above 36 billion. We think maybe a little bit lower than that in the entirety. But if we are modest with our assumptions here, it's good to be surprised on the upside. So the question is the valuation, of course, and when you look at the share-based compensation, which really eats into the EBIT that we can look into as investors, you pay based on, and even though they haven't reported it, we feel quite comfortable with that assessment, 23 times for 22 and 19 times EBIT for 23. And looking at the operating profit in 25, and looking at what share-based compensation, if it's in line with what they've done historically, and maybe they are less greedy, that would be nice. But we would be trading a touch above 13 times EBIT in 25. which we think is a good opportunity for a business with the quality that we have. Also, there's optionality from the balance sheet, because with only close to 1 billion net debt only, that is something where there is room for either buybacks or acquisitions, and at depressed valuations, that might even be value accretive. So here's optionality that we haven't factored in. We think that return on equity is not where we'd ideally like to see it, above 20%. We assume it to go up a bit from 15 to 17. And as I mentioned, if they ever looked at Oracle and management embraced being more efficient there, there would be a lot of room to surprise us on the upside. So for our five-year TSR, we always look at the total shareholder return. We think that at the current price of roughly 106 euros per share, we get to, with these conservative assumptions, around 10% per annum, which we think is decent for the time that we're in. And of course, it could be more in case they actually surprise and deliver above what we have included in our assumptions here. Just one look at the business owner criteria here. We still have the founders of SAP as significant owners of the company, and some of them are still actively engaged. Dietmar Hopp, with his foundation, he owns around 6% of shares. Hasso Plattner, about 7%. Hasso is still very active, and governance is not that great still, but they do care. They are quite innovative. They know the business, and they keep on progressing. And in a way, it's good to know that these guys are there, but I'd like to see better governance. Now, just one thing where you find that, and looking at what we believe is something with our wonderful businesses that makes it investable, which I want to share with you, is the ETF that we've launched. We have a Frankfurter Modern Value Index, basically 25 of those businesses which we consider wonderful businesses, and we rank them according to the total shareholder return that we think is appropriate, being conservative, for the next 5 years. And we have a quarterly rebalancing and have equal weighting for all of those ideas at 4% each, which are always rebalanced every quarter. So you have 100% investment exposure. It's fully invested, unhedged, no currency, no nothing. And of course, since it's an ETF, you can have full transparency. You find the index on Bloomberg. It's called FRAX. And you see the ISIN for the ETF also on Bloomberg. And those are the components. Those are all the other ideas which we think. I presented RB InBev last year. This time it's SAP. Current allocation is at 4.05 in our ETF. And you see that this is what we consider wonderful businesses. And we think that you'll do well looking at the environment over time if you embrace these wonderful businesses, because they'll give you a protection against inflation. If you are, you know, a really long-term investor, then that is something where we see value. This is the performance, and of course, that index and also our ETF is not exempt from macro impacts and from inflationary times, but we think that this is something, when you look at the wonderful business and the quality of these businesses, that they'll generate decent returns over time. The idea for us is that we actually look at preserving capital in inflationary times. We aim to achieve positive real returns, and we do this by looking at what we call the modern value approach. We do this in two ways, either with these 100% invested mandates or dynamic balanced funds, depending on the risk appetite, where we do also make asset allocation calls. That's our main mandate, which is above a billion assets under management. In aggregate, we run about 1.5 billion. And the idea is to have something where we help achieve long-term wealth creation with low volatility, especially in the dynamic balance funds, but also through the quality of our businesses, we think we'll do better than very aggressive indices on a risk-adjusted basis. We have a preference for owner and family-managed businesses. or those where there's skin in the game and less principal agent conflicts. And we look at ESG criteria. We use Sustainalytics and have done so since 2013. And those criteria means we exclude businesses, for example, like fracking, where unfortunately we also had to divest Berkshire, which is very dear to my heart. But you know, with Occidental, 60% of revenue is coming from fracking. We don't invest in fracking, and so we had to divest. So even these criteria, they are hard. And if there is a decent chunk of revenue coming from those areas, we have to divest. We have long-term expertise. It's actually already 40 years that I've been investing in stocks, and I've been joining this business in shareholder value management in 2000, and then I made it my full-time profession 2005. And we celebrate our 15th anniversary with our flagship fund, the Frankfurter Aktienfonds für Stiftung, which I'm quite proud of how we've been going. And I hope you'll find this interesting, and maybe the idea is something that you want to consider. And yeah, I'm looking forward to some discussions. And if you want to engage in a dialogue, here's the team that is happy to take calls. My colleagues all speak English as well. You can also, and unfortunately, most of that is in German, I'm afraid, follow us here online. We're quite active in the social media, thanks to my younger colleagues. And we have webinars, and we also have training camps for financial advisors, which is our Fondsgipfel Akademie. And maybe if you do speak German, you find it interesting to follow us there. Thank you very much. And of course, there is always a disclaimer, because you never know what the future will bring. There are risks in investing, but you're professionals, you know that. So thanks for your attention, and looking forward to now taking your questions.
Frank, thank you very much for the presentation. Perhaps just one or two questions from me on SAP. In terms of capital allocation, to what extent would you set the priorities differently than the management is doing?
I've been quite negative regarding the acquisitions. And I must admit that to some extent that wasn't justified, because you know, when you look at businesses in SaaS and you pay 8 or 10 times revenue, then the question is, will that actually generate anything for you? But it tends to be that these calls were pretty good, and some of those businesses did reasonably well. So I can't really say that this is all value destructive, but I actually do believe if they were to do buybacks at valuations which generate value, and even at current valuation, it would be okay-ish, and it's less risky. So I would really like to see that, and that's not really on the agenda. Those dialogues with the business haven't actually taken us anywhere, and I've opened up long ago and said, you know, why didn't you do more there? And there's just no appetite. So I don't expect that this is going to change unless there would be an activist coming in. But you know, sometimes, and I learned that if you do an acquisition and you acquire a technology that is dominant, maybe in one region, but you have more of a global reach, it can actually do quite well. And so even though it looks crazy what they're paying, I was kind of surprised that this wasn't really as bad as I feared. Actually, some of them did deliver decent returns, is what we take from the dialogues that we've had with industry experts.
And could you just elaborate a little bit on the competitive landscape, how you see SAP versus some of the key competitors, and to what extent there is overlap with Salesforce.com?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the key competitor still is Oracle. They have a pretty much a hate relationship. And we really like Oracle as well. And we like this rigorous focus on efficiency and great capital allocation. But, you know, everything has its price. And the balance sheet of Oracle looks very different. There's a lot of debt there with all those share buybacks. But yes, Oracle in many ways is the better run business. And I see these guys as a formidable competitor. I also consider Salesforce, and I consider, of course, Microsoft a competitor, because it's not just ERP, whether it's with Concur travel expenses, or it is looking at aspects where SAP is doing e-commerce. They acquired Hybris, Salesforce acquired Demandware. So they are in many areas. These businesses are in direct competition. And the good news is they're all in growing industries and with decent returns, and where they all have good market positions. With SAP though, this is the same, which is true. If you offer an ERP system, there is a lot of pressure, and this is what's working for them. When you actually have competition coming up and they want to sell you their services, then there tends to be direct connection on the C-level of the customers that you want to either maintain or sell your additional services into. And even though some products from competitors might be better, we learned that very often it's actually a meeting on a golf course or a nice dinner over wine, where then on the C-level, the decision is finally made to not take the better product, but the one with a name where you've got the established relationship, when you take less career risk. So you're not being fired for taking SAP is something which really is very much the same as it was for IBM in the past. That's something which works for them, but of course also for an Oracle. And there are, of course, also smaller businesses that try eat into the ERP pie. But we think the large corporations, they're very, very unlikely to switch. And since they'll do well over time, they will also grow with their customers. And with their acquisitions, they will then roll out after a while SAP. And so you can assume that these guys will do well, and that the entire space will do well. So competition will go away. They won't kill them. Switching costs also work for the competitors. So the competition is intense, but I think there is enough going for that entire space that it's worth looking also at the competitors and then thinking, at what price would you rather have a Salesforce or an Oracle? But of course, we now want to present an idea in Europe for you, because we also think that the valuation is undemanding. It offers a lot of free optionality. And sometimes you actually have changes in management. When you look at the operating margin again, you can see they've been better in the past. Maybe it will happen. We don't assume that, but if they are, then it's much easier if someone wants to go from 20 or below 20 operating margin towards 30 than keeping your high 30s, or even going into the 40s, which is something that is for Oracle. So in a way, we believe that the product is excellent and there is room for improvement, which we're not paying for. And that's why we think it's a very defensive play. And since we have lots of charitable foundations which invest into our mandates, and they are quite defensive, we like to also look at some defensive picks and not just only aggressive picks. With highly levered balance sheets like Oracle, which we also have invested in, which we also rate very highly.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I will leave it there, Frank. I would just encourage MOI Global members to feel free to follow up with any further thoughts or questions. Thank you so much once again for joining us today and taking the time to articulate your thesis on SAP and tell us more about your investment approach. We truly appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. Have Goodbye. Fun with the event. Thank you.
Goodbye for now.
Bye-bye.